12 through 18 and chapter 11, 16 to 33. Paul did most of his missionary journey, at least initially. He started off with Barnabas, and they moved from Jerusalem to Cyprus and then back. And then what we see in his ministry are concentric circles out into the Mediterranean world, because Paul understands that his work is with non-Jews, that Jesus is more than a Jewish root, or rather a Jewish branch, but that Jesus has ramifications throughout the whole world. So Paul sees his specific task to minister to people who are non-Jews, from Antioch all the way over to Spain, which he hopes to get to, but we're unsure whether he ever reached. He probably was martyred under Nero's Rome in AD 66. While Nero fiddled and Rome burned, Christians were put to the torch and beheaded and crucified as well. So it's probably there that Paul lost his life. What Paul is dealing with is a church that he founded in Corinth, which is about 48 miles west of Athens. He comes from Turkey into Europe proper through Macedonia, and he begins to establish house churches, Philippi, Beroea, Thessaloniki, and then he moves into Athens, where he's laughed out of town because they think what he's preaching is nonsense. The philosophers laughed him out of town. And then he goes to Corinth, and he's very happy there for 18 months. And his two letters are letters written to a congregation that has undergone some trouble since he's left. They've done things that are unseemly for any congregation to do. And what he's writing about here is a group of, quote, superior apostles who have come in and have kind of changed the message that Paul himself has given to this church he's founded. And the church he's founded, they're like children to him. So he's very protective of Corinth. And what he's saying in what I'm about to read is that they boast, these super apostles, in the fact that they can do things that he can't do, that they're better preachers than he is, that they look better than he does. Because Paul, we note, does not look good. He probably has a paunchy stomach. We know that he was near blind, if not fully blind, and so he'll dictate most of the letters that we have in the New Testament. And he's also accused of that he writes weighty letters, but when you see him in person, his voice is kind of squeaky. His speech is of no account. I'll never forget, you know, Ernest Hemingway writing about all these macho things in his novels and his short stories. And then you hear Ernest Hemingway read, and it's like, who is this guy anyway? So Paul is accused then of having a speech that is of no account and really not being very intellectual or smart. So Paul in 2 Corinthians is trying to counter these superior apostles, quote, who think they're so wonderful and boast about their own abilities. And what we're going to see in the second part of what I read is that Paul will boast in his sufferings. And what he suffers is incredible for the faith. Let me just draw attention to one thing. We're told that Paul is flogged, and the Jews would flog a criminal. And Paul was considered a criminal by most Jews because he professed Jesus as Lord. And they would flog you 39 times, 40 times, but they'd only flog you 39 times because if you went over 40, it was thought that then that was a sin against God. So if you're going to hurt someone, just do it 39 times. But he was also flogged by the Romans as well, as Jesus was. And that flogging was worse because the Romans used a cat of nine tails, which was spiked with iron in order to... So often people who were going to be crucified never made it to the cross. They died of bleeding. So Paul then enumerates what he boasts about, and that is the extent of what he suffered for his faith. With that introduction, hear God's reading to us. We do not dare to classify or compare ourselves with some who commend themselves. When they measure themselves by themselves and compare themselves with themselves, they are not wise. We, however, will not boast beyond proper limits, but will confine our boasting to the field God has assigned to us, a field that reaches even to you. We are not going too far in our boasting, as would be the case if we had not come to you, for we did not get as far as you with the gospel of Christ. Neither do we go beyond our limits by boasting of work done by others. Our hope is that as your faith continues to grow, our area of activity among you will greatly expand, so that we can preach the gospel in the regions beyond you. For we do not want to boast about work already done in another man's territory, but let him who boasts boast in the Lord. For it is not the one who commends himself who is approved, but the one whom the Lord commends. I repeat, let no one take me for a fool. But if you do, then receive me just as you would a fool, so that I may do a little boasting. In this self-confident boasting, I'm not talking as the Lord would, but as a fool. Since many are boasting in the way the world boasts, I too will boast. You gladly put up with fools, since you are so wise. In fact, you even put up with anyone who enslaves you or exploits you or takes advantage of you or pushes himself forward or slaps you in the face. To my shame, I admit that we were too weak for that. What anyone else dares to boast about, I am speaking as a fool, I also dare to boast about. Are they Hebrews? So am I. Are they Israelites? So am I. Are they Abraham's descendants? So am I. Are they servants of Christ? I am out of my mind to talk like this. I am more. I have worked much harder, been in prison more frequently, been flogged more severely, and been exposed to death again and again and again. 5 times I received from the Jews the 40 lashes minus one. 3 times I was beaten with rods. Once I was stoned. 3 times I was shipwrecked. I spent a night and a day in the open sea. I have been constantly on the move. I have been in danger from rivers, in danger from bandits, in danger from my own countrymen, in danger from the non-Jews, in danger in the city, in danger in the country, in danger at sea, and in danger from false brothers. I have labored and toiled and have often gone without sleep. I have known hunger and thirst and have often gone without food. I have been cold and I have been naked. Besides everything else, I face the daily pressure of my concern for all of my beloved churches. Who is weak? And I do not feel weak. Who is led into sin, and I do not inwardly burn. If I must boast, I will boast of the things that show my weakness. The God and Father of the Lord Jesus, who is to be praised forever, knows that I am not lying. In Damascus, the governor under King Aretas had the city of the Damascenes guarded in order to arrest me. But I was lowered in a basket from a window and in the wall and slipped through his hands. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. Amen. I want to talk about boasting and why we boast even if we don't. But I have a feeling that we've all boasted at times. And the interesting thing is when do we boast? When are those times that we boast? And what purpose does bragging serve? Because I think in many ways it does serve a purpose for us, although it's not one that has any lasting good effect. In the short term, nevertheless, I think we boast and we brag to somehow salve an injured ego, to take care of a complex which we might call inferior. Why do we boast? Well, Paul boasts a lot, not only in what I've read, but in Philippians 3:14, Paul says, you know, I studied under the feet of Gamaliel, I was a Harvard-educated guy, I was a Hebrew among Hebrews, I was circumcised on the 8th day, I was a Pharisee, which means I was very strict. As far as zeal, not only did I go to the Hurley Reformed Church twice a week, even when there wasn't church, he said, but I persecuted the churches, and under the law, the Ten Commandments and all the other laws, Paul says, I was blameless. But he says, you know, I don't boast in those things. I count them all as nonsense for the enduring delight of knowing Jesus Christ, who really never boasted, but who had a rich and full life that Paul says he desires to emulate and imitate. So, you know, boasting is something we do, and boasting is something I think that is relational. Paul says these super apostles who are troubling his wonderful church in Corinth, they boast among themselves. They kind of say to themselves, well, I'm a better preacher, or I'm better at this, or I'm smarter, I'm wiser, whatever. And then Paul says they boast against me because they look at me and they say, his speech is of no account, he doesn't look very good. He looks like Oliver Hardy and a Laurel and Hardy. Some of you who are of age understand who I'm talking about. You know, that's what he looks like. Not much to look at all. You'd never invite him to a party. You'd never invite him to the senior prom. No siree. So boasting tends to be relational in this society particularly. And we often find ourselves, even if we don't want to boast, because we're kind of led to it. I had this experience, and I consider myself fairly mature, somewhat wise, But I was at the Holiday Inn because a friend of mine was playing in a rock and roll band, and as you know, I like rock and roll. So I encountered someone that I hadn't seen in a few years, we had not always had the best of relationships, although it was always under the table, kind of. And he approaches me with someone I had not met, a woman, and we'll call her Magda. And he said to me, I'd like you to introduce you to Magda. And I said, well, how do you do? I put on my best minister spiel, you know, how are you? So nice to meet you. And he said, Magda and I are engaged. I said, how wonderful. You have a wonderful guy here. Oh, it's fabulous. You're going to get married? Oh, we're going to get married soon. Then he said, Magda is a lawyer. She makes lots of money. I said, oh, that's just wonderful. And he said, and Magda and I live in her beautiful home. You know, we have a 3-car garage. I said, great. And then I said something I should not have said. I said, I have a red sports car. And I just kind of held that smile. You know, have you done that? You said, I know I've said the wrong thing, but let me just kind of just keep the smile going. But you know, what I was thinking of, I wanted to say, you live in a beautiful house. Well, I live in a stone house that was built in 1725. You have Magda. So what I did was, he and Magda were dancing out there. And he was looking at me like, you see how much we're in love? You know, we're looking. So I grabbed my friend's girlfriend. I said, let's dance. I mean, I took her by the hand and pulled her out of the seat. Let's dance. And I'm looking at him thinking, I'm a better dancer than he is. And I'm happier. I'm having more fun than he is. And I'm having more joy than he is. You know? And I'm thinking to myself, what an idiot. You know, I've become an adult to a child. I've transmogrified into a child. No, that's not fair to children. You know, Jesus says, let the children come unto me and do not hinder them, for to such belong the kingdom of heaven. Well, I wasn't even a good child at that point. I was a typical adult, keeping up with the Joneses. And when Paul says in Philippians 3, you know, what we need to do, we cannot boast in fleshly terms. This is exactly what Paul is talking about. We get hooked, do we not? And if someone has, and we get hooked spiritually too. I mean, if this fellow had come in, not with Magda, but if he had come in by himself, and if he had said, and this is what Paul is dealing with, by the way, if he had said, I'm a minister, well, yes, I know you're, and I've just been promoted, and I'm serving a church where there are 10,000 people every Sunday morning, what would I have said to that? And how many people do you have? And this happens in ministers' meetings, by the way. You know what I would have said?
said, well, yeah, I mean, you maybe have 10,000 people, but I have the most spiritual congregation I have ever seen in my life. Everyone is probably more spiritual than your group. You know, you may have more people, but, you know, quantity is not quality in God's eyes, and I have the best quality around right here in this congregation. And he would have said, how many do you have? And I'll say, I'm not saying. I'm just not saying. So I think, you know, we can get caught up in boasting and bragging. And what Jesus found when he dealt with the Pharisees, of course, is that they boasted and bragged in their goodness. I tell you, when anyone comes to me and tells me how spiritual they are, I want to run the other way, you know? When they begin to say, I'm the most spiritual person in the whole wide world, I want to say, I think I'm going to lunch right now. Can I talk to you later? Because that's what Jesus was dealing with. People who boasted, you can boast in anything. You can boast in your poverty. I don't have much money. That makes me better than other people. I'm superior to other people. I'm more like Jesus. You can take anything and make an ego project out of it. And the problem with that is that it doesn't work. The problem is that you know it's fraudulent. And you know that you're a fraud when you're kind of going beyond your capability or limits and saying to people, this is who I am, when you realize, in fact, that's not who you are at all. And you know, Paul is very aware of this, and I think we need to be aware of this too. Albert Schweitzer was the great theologian of the 19th century. He was a great organist and musician. How many of you have heard of Albert Schweitzer? You know, he went into Africa, Lambarene, to establish, he gave up a fruitful academic career. He wrote perhaps the best theological work in the New Testament in 1899, The Myth of the Historical Jesus, which really, if you read that book, you understand theology throughout the 19th century. He was a great organist, great musician, great preacher, and he left it all to help the poorest of the poor in Lambarene, Africa. One day he was nailing nails to a roof, and an African came by, and Albert said, Dr. Schweitzer said, could you help me? And he said, no, I don't do that kind of work anymore. I'm educated, I know how to read and write, and I do not bang nails with hammers at all. And Schweitzer looked at him and said, you know, once upon a time I felt I was an intellectual as well, but he said, I'd rather bang nails into the roof. That's not only humility, but I think a good self-assessment. Winston Churchill, how many do you remember Winston Churchill? If not remember, know who he is. The great Prime Minister of Britain, right, during those terrible days during World War II. And one day, Churchill gave a speech, and 10,000 people came to hear him. And one of his aides said to Churchill, aren't you gratified? Don't you feel proud that 10,000 people came to hear your speech? And Churchill waved him off and said, no, you know, he said, 100,000 people would be here if they were about to hang me. You know, 100,000 people would be here if they're going to string me up. So he said, no, 10,000 people doesn't mean a thing. So I think, you know, what Paul is talking about is Paul boasts, but does it have limits? Well, let me say that, you know, let's talk about why we boast. And I think the reason we boast is that when we're insecure, the tendency is for us to boast. I know as a therapist dealing with adults who've had rough childhoods, whatever that means, there's a tendency to boast because that was the only way I think they could protect themselves when they could not control their lives as children. So there is that tendency. When you're going through a rough stretch emotionally, the tendency is to try to lift yourself up and boast. And goodness knows, God understands the reasons we do it. And in some ways, it can be a survivor technique as well. So it's not ipso facto bad, but it really doesn't work in the long run. So, you know, the first thing I want to say to you is understand why you're boasting. And you may have to say to you, I woke up on the wrong side of the bed. I had a bad breakfast. I had a tough time the night before. And just catch yourself, be aware, and say, okay, I'm really, you know, gilding the lily here because I'm going through a rough time, and it's just part of my defense strategy, and maybe there are other ways to boast, or not boast, but to manage my life more effectively. But Paul does boast for two reasons, and we need to spell these out. And the first thing Paul boasts about is his sufferings. That Paul boasts that he suffered more than most people for the sake of the gospel. That he's gone through tougher times because of his commitment for Jesus Christ. That he has struggled with his life because of his faith. And I think we can boast in that. I really think we need to boast in that. And Paul also says in Corinthians, although I didn't read it, is that we can boast in the fact that when we're weak physically, when perhaps we're sick or ill, we have the H1N1 or whatever we have, that we can boast in the fact that often Christ's presence is seen more clearly in our weakness than in our strength. Because people will look at us and say, you know, how did he or she have the ability to raise himself or herself up in spite of what he or she is dealing with in their lives? How do you do that? And the answer, of course, is people begin to see the light of Jesus Christ working in and through you. And people give glory then and honor to God, not when we're healthy and strong, but often when we're weak. And Paul looks at all the sufferings he's been through, and Paul, I think, is just anxious about his life, and yet he can boast and say, you know, when I am weak, then I am strong, because Jesus is seen and manifest in my weakness. Spent some time with a former parishioner who was critically ill, terminally ill with cancer. He was a big bruiser of a man, and I always was worried about shaking his hand at the close of the service, because he had more than a Methodist grip, you know. I felt, and sometimes if he didn't like a message, I felt that I had to kind of steel myself and try to, it was like an arm wrestling contest, except the shaking contest. And so just, you know, a big, strong, strapping, burly guy who contracted that terrible disease. And so I would visit him in the hospital. And cancer, of course, shaves the weight off us. And I remember one time I visited, his wife had come in after I came in. And, you know, here's a tough guy who came to church when he was forced to come to church, you know, and felt that somehow maybe minister was not fully, I was fully human, but maybe not fully male. Do you know what I'm saying? You know, because maybe ministers are kind of half female or whatever the, quote, weaker sex he thought was. He was kind of a guy from the old school. But he looked at his wife when I was there. And he took her hand off the iron railing. And he had the hand the size of a catcher's mitt. And he just stroked the back of her hand with his thumb. In a way which I did not imagine he could do. He was so gentle. He was so kind. It was as if he was holding some sort of rare treasure in his hand, which indeed he was. And I thought of Isaiah 42:3, where the Messiah is described as one who will not break a bruised reed, a reed in the swamp that's broken and goes like that. The Messiah will be so gentle that the Messiah will not break that broken reed. And that's what I saw. And my sense was that in his weakness, the power of God and Jesus was manifest there. I came away wanting to take off my shoes because indeed, as Moses before the burning bush, I felt that I was on holy ground. I felt that I was on holy ground. So we can boast when we suffer for Jesus Christ because we have an example to give to other people. The second and final thing I'd like to say is we can boast, too, in our gifts. As Paul says, we do not boast beyond our limits. We do not boast beyond our limits. So the problem with bragging is that we're telling falsehoods. But that doesn't mean, Paul says, that we shouldn't boast about us. Aren't you relieved? Doesn't that feel good? Because we've often thought that we can't boast at all. But often we have to boast about ourselves within limits in order to, I think, motivate ourselves to do, to use the gifts that God has given us for God's glory. We have to do that. You know, Paul does say we shouldn't think about ourselves more highly than we ought in Romans 12:3. And Paul says we need to look it upon ourselves with sober judgment, and I think that's all true. But my problem with Paul at this point is that in boasting beyond our limits, we rarely do that with people here. I suppose I could go to Wall Street and preach a different sermon, but my sense about you and me is that we don't boast enough because we don't feel that we have gifts. We don't feel that we have strengths. We don't feel that we have anything to offer people. And the issue for us is that we need perhaps to do a little more boasting. The issue for us is that we need to be our own cheerleader if we don't have another cheerleader for us. And in the book of Hebrews, we read in the 10th chapter, the 24th verse, we need to instigate one another to do the work that God would have us to do. We need, essentially, Paul says, to be cheerleaders. Are we cheerleaders to one another? And are indeed we are we cheerleaders to ourselves? And I think that becomes crucial. I think that becomes crucial. There was a woman, as I've mentioned, I was a high school wrestler, and we had a woman. We couldn't afford or there was no one interested in having a cheerleading group for wrestling, you know. So we had this, and some wrestling schools in Rockland County, they had cheerleaders, you know. And in order to be a cheerleader in Suffern or Pearl River, you had to take massive doses of male steroid hormones. I'm just kidding. But it seemed to me that all the cheerleaders had voices two octaves lower than mine, you know? So you'd come out on the match, you'd come out and the cheerleaders would be going, kill, 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 kill. And we didn't have anyone like that. We had this young woman who would say, you can do it, 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 you can do it. But it didn't help because she, you know, my name was, you can do it, Bobby, you can do it, Bobby, you can do it, ooh, Bobby. She'd always use the diminutive. So you can do it, not Dan, but Danny, 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 you can do it, Danny, Danny, Danny. You know, you can do it. There was always an EY attached to the end, so we felt like children, you know? It really didn't give us much hope. But I'm thinking, you know, what Paul is talking about, or rather what the writers of, what Paul's talking about is that we are cheerleaders, if not for others, then certainly for ourselves, that we need to say, you can do it. And you know, as Nelson Mandela says, it doesn't do us well to play it small. The world does not need us to play it small. Jesus says, you are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hid. You are the salt of the earth, Jesus says in Matthew 5. Your saltiness flavors the whole neighborhood around you. You can't play it small. And I think at times, you know, we just deal with inferiority. And what I want you to do is go home, look in the mirror, and say, God has given me this gift, God has given me that gift, God has given me a second gift, a third gift, a fourth gift, a fifth gift, and I'm going to use it for God's glory. I'm not going to waste my time with inferiority. I'm not going to waste my time with negativism. I'm not going to waste my time feeling that I can't do when I can do. And if I have to jack myself up by saying, you know, you can, do it. If you have to be your own cheerleader, be that. And also surround yourself with people who recognize the gifts you have, even if you don't recognize them in the moment. Surround yourself with people who can look you straight in the eye and say, look, I know you're going through a bad time. I know you're down in the mouth. I know you feel you can't do this, that or the other thing, but you are a child of God. You are a believer, and God has given you this gift, that gift, and the other gift. I see it clearly. Others see it clearly. Now go out and act that way. Muhammad Ali was one of my childhood heroes. And for me, the greatest heroic thing he did was that he fought Sonny Liston for the heavyweight championship of the world at a time when Sonny Liston seemed unbeatable. He had knocked out our local Floyd Patterson twice in the first round. He was a convicted felon who had spent years of hard time in jail, and he was considered the most imposing heavyweight figure, perhaps in the history of the game. And it was in that fifth round that Ali, who was dancing around him and doing very well, got liniment or something in his eye, and it was thought that Liston's handlers had put liniment on the outside of the boxing glove, and Liston had rubbed it in Ali's eye so that Ali could not see. And Ali was scared of Liston in some ways, and he had taken heavy body blows from Liston too, and he sat in his corner. And Angelo Dundee was looking at him, and Ali said, I'm finished, I'm through. I'm finished and I'm through, I can't do this anymore. And Angelo Dundee, the great cheerleader, said to him, look, you're gonna be heavyweight champion of the world. I don't wanna hear what you can't do. You go out there and lick this guy as you've been licking him for the past five rounds. Ali looked back at him, and before Ali could say another word, Dundee pulls the stool out from under him and gives him a kick out into the ring, and the rest is history. We need cheerleaders in our lives like that. When we're doubting the gifts that God has given us, who'll pull the stool out from under us, give us a swift kick in the pants if that's what we need, and get us out in the ring so that we can be champions for the one who gives us life, even Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen.